Dr. Ono. As you shared this kind of vision of how the role of faculty is going to change, I think about that with undergraduate students. But can you say a little bit about grad student preparation? How do you feel like graduate education is going to will look in the next little bit, and how, in particular, we as InterVarsity staff can help the graduate students that we're helping form toward that sort of a changed role in the lives of students?
So the question is how do I see graduate student education changing on the higher ed landscape moving forward?
And what might be the role of the GFM community in contributing to that in redemptive ways?
I think what we're seeing is that on a number of institutions are actually taking a very critical look at the number of graduate programs and the size of the graduate programs. Part of that is because of the employability of students that are receiving their PhDs or their master's degrees. So we're actually in the midst of looking at that. Most institutions are looking at all of them very carefully. So I think that that some of the programs will shrink in size. Ironically, although some of the programs will shrink in size, or the number of programs will decrease in many institutions, there's going to be a dramatic renewal of the faculty moving forward, because the demographics of the university faculty are such that we think in the next 20 years or so, a good 60-70% of the faculty will not already be in faculty positions. So there's going to be a situation where there'll be a great need in the not too distant future for graduate students. So I think that, to answer your question, what are they going through right now as a group of people? Many of them are worried about their ability to be employed. They're going to need a lot of support moving forward. Ultimately, there will be a better time. As the faculty renews, there will be jobs that will be coming available for them. But for the next 5 to 10 years, they're going to need a tremendous amount of support. It's a difficult road ahead. Once you get your doctoral degree, to move from an adjunct position, which many of them are in right now, or to be in a two-year college, where many of them end up, to moving into a tenure-track position within a four-year university. So you probably are seeing that in your universities and colleges. It's not that easy to get faculty positions right now. So to support them in this period of time will be particularly important. Does that answer your question?
We'll take questions.
This question is directed to Dr. Meister. In your book, The Soul of the University, you talked about Dr. Edwin Mays and I work for Morehouse. And we're dealing with African American graduate students and faculty. And the whole situation, some of what you said, a lot of what you said is true, is that what you have is a tradition that established Dr. Mays is very, very liberal, but yet a lot of African American students, graduate students, have an evangelical heritage. And do you see anything in the movement that can you sort of speak to that particular issue? How we in university could really get to the place where we have African Americans who scholars can even use the word evangelical, because the word evangelical has all kinds of connotations, as you know, in terms of what your students do. And so I was wondering if you could.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that that's one of the great untapped resources. I was just reading, there's a new book called American Grace, which is a big sociological study of American religion by Robert Putnam and someone else, Campbell. And it says the African American community is, by a considerable degree, the most religious community in the country. And so African Americans going to graduate in the graduate work are likely to have some substantial Christian background, but and if they speak out as Christians, they're going to be the reaction will not be the way it is if white people who are associated with the Christian establishment speak out. But the problem also is the evangelical community, as you alluded to, just because of the tradition of racial separateness and discrimination in this country, the evangelical community doesn't have good connections with African Americans who are evangelical by doctrine and belief, but aren't don't connect with evangelicals and don't identify with them because evangelicals is a white thing and often politically conservative and has a suspect background. So anyway, I think, I don't, you know more than I am sure. I don't know exactly how to reach that community because it is sort of the tradition that in order to become respected intellectually, you compartmentalize your life and you have your religion in one place and your science in another. And I think it's in a matter of time, the more examples there are from other communities making the connection, the more models there will be that people could follow.
I'm going to get some people I haven't asked yet. You wanted to comment on this question? Good, go ahead. This is Don. We were sitting here. We began. Don Davis is a retired faculty in library science from the University of Texas, and is also kind of an itinerant pastor, digger-upper of Christian faculty all over Texas, and apparently recently made a foray into Asheville, North Carolina, to out some Christian faculty there. So, you're part of our community, but also a very experienced person in faculty ministry.
I was just simply going to add that in our pioneering work, we've tried to rustle up Christian faculty at Texas Southern University in Houston, a prominent black university, and the ethos on campus there spiritually is very interesting. It's part of the woodwork, so it's always understood, but it's not really it's not mainstream either. It's it follows its own patterns, but it's the only place where they still offer invocations before public gatherings and things like that, and very interesting to work with that group down there, and they put me on the mailing list right away, so I get all their publications. So.
In the back.
I think that it's a relatively new field. Students that are at a distance or in a different continent have in many ways, the same needs as a student that's on campus. And so I think that it's going to be important for university administrators to figure out a way to virtually extend the same benefits of being on campus to students that are not on campus. We haven't figured it out yet. But you could imagine that a student that is enrolled in a Master of Public Health degree at UC is living in Edinburgh and is isolated, goes to work in a factory, comes back in the evening, is part of our graduate program. And there are real examples like this. And they are as needy and as lost spiritually as their counterpart on our campus. Don't we have a responsibility as an institution and as Christians to work together to figure out a way to transmit that, perhaps virtually, perhaps in other ways, because they're paying tuition and they should have the same student services and the same access to affiliated organizations such as InterVarsity that an on-campus student does. So that's not a very satisfying answer, is it? It's just saying that you're right, there's a need. I don't have a solution yet, and maybe we can all brainstorm about how to do that. A lot of the communication with these students is done via a web portal or streaming video, and so maybe what we need to do as an institution or as institutions of higher education is to figure out how we can, through that same medium, provide multiple channels, one which is focused on their distance education, and maybe they should be able to click on InterVarsity, just like a student can actually meet with a faculty advisor or an official on campus. Maybe we could partner so that there could be a video of you talking to, if you're based at UC, so that you can have a conversation by Skype or by streaming video with the, why shouldn't they have the same opportunities as somebody on campus? So it might be that we eventually end up being that, doing something like that. Does that help?
I'll give you just a second. Go ahead, Tom, and then
First of all, I want to thank you, Dr. Oro, for ruining my perfectly good retirement of 9 months.
What did I do?
The most disturbing stuff I've heard in a long time.
Sorry.
And it gives me new ways to pray for my grandchildren about this high. I will walk away with this as
I'm glad you retired.
Remembering this was my gift, my retirement gift from Santa. We've all been wanting to use that line. My question is, I think both to you and to Dr. Marsden, and they build on what other people have said too. When I look at all of what's happening with social media and other things, I guess the words that come to mind are mentor, internships, and possibly even guilds. Some ancient ways of how we taught and passed on skills. I guess from Dr. Marsden, maybe any historic insights on either internships or guilds that we could learn from as we head toward a new social media, and for InterVarsity, how might we do that?
Well, yeah, I don't know of historical precedents, partly because the historical setting is so different today, and as I said last night, And Dr. Ono's talk confirms the degree to which everything is shaped by technology or technological considerations and consumer considerations, and almost the picture is professors are more or less managers of this wonderful technology that people are learning skills, which makes the nature of the university quite different than it was, say, in 1950 or something like that, when the humanities often had a large part to do with the university. And the one thing that strikes, one of my first thoughts is sort of what I think yours is too, that I'm glad I'm not a graduate student in the humanities facing that future when, in probably a very small percentage of students, probably 2 or 3% of students will actually get a humanities education. And now, but then the other thought that came to my mind is, well, maybe that's not all bad in most universities, the way the humanities have gone. That I would not want my grandchildren to study literature at most universities today. Here's a positive thing, I think. That does create a vacuum. And it's a vacuum that I referred to last night in these books that we've written, the Cronin book and others, why don't the universities do, things about the big questions in life. And university might think about how can we fill that vacuum? And I think one way is institutes at universities, like the McLaurin Institute at Minnesota or Drew Trotter's Institute at Virginia, that are supplemental groups that are near the university but not the university, that are doing these sorts of things. And there might be thought about how can we invent new sorts of institutions that will fill that gap. The other thought is, as things become more interdisciplinary, there are possibilities. Someone was talking to me last night, the gentleman from Iowa State, about teaching interdisciplinary courses where you're talking about the context of the technology or the science that you're teaching. And that there is a recognition that is relevant to the technical thing. And in an interdisciplinary context, then you can say we're going to have a much more holistic approach to education. And as in science education, where ecology now is recognized that you have to take into account not just the technique but the wider perspective. So spiritual perspectives could be included in those kinds of new, filling the vacuum.
I actually wanted to ask you why I ruined your life and for 6 years. What did I do?
I had a nice, peaceful retirement plan where I was just going to go play with my grandkids and enjoy myself, and now in Mars, you've kind of reinvaded my life after 45 years, and you've just sort of confirmed that I got more work to do.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I was worried that there was something I said that.
For the tone.
If
it sounded
off.
Yeah.
Sharon.
I just want to ask Dr. Ono. I appreciated your being so open as a believer on campus, and I think it's a profound gift to encourage others. Conversations that I've had with women, particularly who are maybe at the beginning of their career, there's a lot of anxiety about how that will. I don't think they're feeling that would be a good thing. And I teach on faculty at UW-Madison, and I have to say that it's not seen as one of the many choices out there. It's seen as negative. So I would welcome the others to weigh in on that, or just how do we challenge the women? In my case, I work particularly with the women. Do we challenge them to trust God that He'll overcome what might be a problem, or do we validate that, in fact, you might get the door slammed on you because of that,
or
you might suddenly be discriminated.
Well, Sharon, that's a great question. My brother taught until last year at Madison. And you have this amazing chancellor there called Biddy Martin.
Yes.
She's amazing.
Yeah,
and so the one of the most powerful ways institutions can change is at the very top.
Yeah.
Do you know Biddy Martin?
I've met her. Yeah, she's phenomenal.
Why don't you talk to her about it? I mean, at Emory University, the President Wagner has really changed how open the institution is.
Yeah.
He's actually been videotaped, and he's on YouTube talking about the importance of multiple faiths and tolerance on campus. And so the President actually coming out and making a statement like that, I mean, you'd be surprised if you talked to her and you said, you know, I'm a Christian, and there are faculty in your university that are afraid about being openly Christian. Can you say it's bizarre, it's ridiculous? What do you think we can do about that? And I bet you, knowing her, she'll say, "You're right. What should we do? Let's figure out a plan so that that people will not be afraid." I bet you she'll do that.
I'm in a position because I'm not tenure track. Right.
Right.
I guess what I'm also asking, because I'm thinking I have two roles, at least two hats, that how, you know, is that in general, is that a safe, you know, is that what we should be telling?
I think you're absolutely right that at this moment in time, it probably wouldn't be advisable to tell all faculty that just be open and just because they might have a department chair or a dean that might not be open to that.
A lot of them are saying, "I'm waiting until I get tenure."
Right,
I'm waiting until I get tenure and then go time.
So it's really a case by case basis, but you can achieve. I would do both. I think you have to be honest and say talk to them about assessing the situation. They should be able to figure out what their department chair is like, or what their dean is like. It's very unlikely at the provost level that someone's going to go against the recommendations of RPT committees in the department and at the school because someone is Christian. I mean, that would be ludicrous. That would be grounds for a lawsuit, I would say. I'm not encouraging that, I would advise that you talk to each faculty member and ask them to assess the local situation and the situation in the college. And I'm happy to talk to them as well if that would help. But if you really want to actually move the institution as a whole, and since you know Biddy Martin and you're courageous, talk to her. Talk to her.
Anybody else want to address that?
What if at MIT it's the president and the vice president who are the deeply closeted Christians? They're afraid that if I identify with any constituency, all the other constituencies will feel like aliens. At least that's the argument that they make.
So as a leader, you have to be very careful. Being openly whatever is different from not being open to other points of view. So I think that's the little mistake that leaders make. Ronald Reagan used to end his speeches by "God bless America." If there's anybody that has to be very careful about many different faiths and beliefs, it should be the President of the United States. But if you do it in such a way that this is my belief, I'm not imposing it on you, I respect and tolerate other beliefs, then I think you're safe. If you step over that and say, this is the way it's got to be, I'm the president, and you're not open to and not giving equal time to listening to, showing up at events. I mean, I go to Hillel. I meet with Muslim students. So you, as an institutional leader, you have to be accessible to respect and interact with all the groups. But I think it's perfectly reasonable, and I think more and more people agree that there's no reason why you can't be who you are as a person. So, does that help?
Well, I don't know how to communicate that to them, though.
to them?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. Tom's been trying to get a question in. Go ahead and move over to this side. Yeah.
I've been just as open with them, the believers and non-believers, as I am with you. I'm not a different person. There's no, I'm not a closet Christian. I'm a very open Christian. I have not gotten into any trouble with any of them. I think if you're just very open and honest and respect their, just like Jake, right now he's an atheist. He has no problem with me being a Christian because I give him space to think and to ponder and to come to his own conclusions. That's the way, if there's mutual respect, it actually works. What has my experience been with science faculty? I meet with hundreds of science faculty. So it's a relatively large N. It's not national by any scope. But I should say I won't name the individual, but several of the deans are Christian, and they're quite comfortable being visibly Christian. A number of the biologists are. We've had conversations on campus about perceived conflict between Christianity and evolutionary biology, and there have been wonderful conversations. And ultimately, what happens is that many biologists actually say that they actually don't think that there's a contradiction there. It depends upon how literally you actually read Genesis. There are lots of great role models out there, like Francis Collins. And you can listen to his testimony on YouTube. And this is one of the most brilliant geneticists alive today. Many biologists are Christian, and more of them are actually being very open about that. You know, Ben Carson, the brilliant neurobiologist at Hopkins, you've read his book, right? So I think I wouldn't say that's any hard data. It's quite anecdotal. But I really haven't experienced much pushback personally. And I don't think they have either. I think, once again, it really depends upon who's in place at the institution. I think I mentioned the example of the racial tension in University of California at Santa Barbara, and where the administration was actually quite relieved and willing to work with InterVarsity there, and because they brought in a knowledge about how to deal with multi-ethnic situations and tensions that really helped the president and provost there. Part of that was driven by the crisis, but part of that was driven by the fact that they were open to having this synergy with, or collaboration with a group which, although very deeply affiliated with what's going on campus, is not a campus structure in and of itself. So that's one example of that it can work. Another example is the one that you and I talked about, where you will actually be helping to provide a community event on a regular basis for the international students. And, I think part of the reason that that works, having been there and been a part of the problem, the reason why that was no longer sponsored by the university was due to restructuring at the university and because of lack of funds. And so the reason why it's working is that I can tell you as the provost that if there's something that we think will be good for a faculty member or a graduate student or undergraduate student, and we simply can't afford it, and that there is a rapport with an InterVarsity staff member, that there's a trust there, that the event or the program that you're going to provide is of high quality, and we cannot provide it ourselves, then I think most administrators will be motivated to come to the table and discuss that. I think that in terms of programming, you did that at Emory. InterVarsity sponsored some amazing speakers to come that were completely packed and were actually video fed into adjacent lecture halls because too many people came. And many of them were graduate students and faculty and undergraduates, as well as members of the community. So there's ample evidence that, depending upon the institution, it can work. And if it's not working in any specific institution, then there are enough of us around that are willing to go to the campus with our administrator hat on and say, this is what we were able to do at Cincinnati or Emory. It will help you as an administrator for the university, and you should really think about it. At the national board meeting, one of the things that we talked about was to have members of the board who are also academics or administrators actually, Alec actually talked about this, sent to universities where that interface between InterVarsity and the university isn't going well. Alec said, maybe what we should be doing is sending people from this group, from this room where it is working, to help InterVarsity members at universities where it's not working well, to help mentor both the staff member, but also, for example, in my case, I could go talk to the president and provost and say, you should really work together with InterVarsity because it will really add to your institution. So I think there are ways you can do it.
I think we need to let our administrators know that we support the real aims of the university.
Absolutely.
I mean, and we can do some things which they are unable to do, but they would like to do.
Right.
And we can help them, and we can join with them. We can model interdisciplinary, intercollegiate, multi-ranks, ethnicities, genders, movements among faculty, at least, and I suspect graduate students. On our campus, just a brief example, our administrators are reluctant sometimes to talk about faith issues and things about student movements and stuff like that. And so I get a letter about once every decade asking me to respond to an angry parent who thinks that the university is filled with communists or their kids are losing their faith and there are no opportunities for a Christian involvement. And they say, would you write these parents and tell them about your group, about the Christian faculty and other groups? And I'm only too happy to do that. So if we can make the university look good and better in the eyes of its tax-paying constituents, we all are winners on this.
Okay, last question was Jeff Bartison, then we got to go to lunch. Sorry, Dennis.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So we had Vinod Ramachandra at Harvard for Veritas Forum in the last days, and he's just an amazing guy. And I should also say that he's a little bit ticked with InterVarsity, and we haven't made better use of him. Because his job with IFES is to come alongside us. And he's a superb thinker and from Sri Lanka. He brings a lot of interesting things to it. But when he was meeting with our students, he was like a professorial smackdown. He just was very direct.
Yeah.
And when there were stupid questions being asked, he treated them like they were stupid questions. So you've got to be prepared for that. But I thought it was really helpful. One of the questions that got kind of a professorial smackdown was this question. How do you contrast and compare evangelism with dialogue? And he sat back in the chair kind of incredulous and said, I can't imagine how you could hope to ever do evangelism without having good dialogue. So I wanted to ask you if you've had particularly good experiences in dialogue. I know at Harvard, somebody already mentioned that forum that happens around dinner, and they didn't mention the wine that gets passed around, that which lubricates the conversation in a certain way.
But also, there's a professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard who's not herself a Christian, but she hosts several times a semester a gathering of faculty. Some are theistic, some aren't, but they have an amazing conversation. And this, I'm talking about Swanee Hunt, for those of you who know her. And it just, it's a really remarkable kind of event that dialogue happens in. But as evangelicals, we feel nervous about dialogue. You know, what if, you know, it feels vulnerable to us. And I wonder if you've, how you all have experienced that yourselves, and if other faculty know participate in such things, and what models might be that you can share with us.
Yeah, I should say that we're launching something next month called Life of the Mind. And we did it at Emory, so if that sounds familiar, we're doing that again. But it's a little bit different, what we're doing. It's to actually bring multiple points of view to talk about one word. So it's like a mini TED conference, you know, the TED conference. And so the next one's going to be about technology. So we'll bring three people, pro-technology, anti-technology, or whatever, together. And each will get up for 18 minutes and talk. And then there'll be a dialogue. And everybody in the community can talk about it. In the future, we're going to have one on Christ. So it's going to be fun. yeah. And I absolutely right. That's what you have to do. And through that dialogue, you will actually move the community to a better place. Through that conversation, respectful dialogue, there'll be more tolerance. And you'll also actually transform the lives of those in the audience. So I agree completely.
That's good.
That'll be our last one. I want to say Doctors Ono and Marsden will be leaving later on this afternoon after lunch. They're going to have lunch with us. Maybe hang out in, was it 219 for a little bit if you have time before you need to leave. But let's give them our hearty thanks. I must say, if I can out Dr. Marsden, I actually did two things when I thought about him for speaking here. I friended him on Facebook, and then I wrote him a note of invitation to speak. And he responded to my friendship request first, which is how I knew he was online to respond to my and Dr. Ono's already given you that invitation. So these are friendly men. And then Dr. Davis is actually doing one of our faculty, I mean one of our workshops this afternoon on faculty ministry, so you'll have a chance to hear some more from him. Drew Trotter's doing one on study centers and the possible implications of renewal in the professional schools. One thing we haven't talked about is there's not the same kind of recycle of grad students back into faculty in the professional schools. A lot of them head out into the professions. So that group's going to think particularly, what does renewal look like in the professional school world where our graduates aren't necessarily coming back in as long as influences later. How do we do that? What people need to know about faculty members, ESN, Mike Hickerson's doing that on thinking about these kind of virtual relationships, long-distance relationships. ESN's a great way of getting at some of that. And then chapter building, part two, whether you took part one or not, with Karen and Bob. A great opportunity to continue to say, listen, if we're going to be influential on campus presence, growth matters. Yeah. It matters both in terms of our influence, it matters because there are people who need to know Christ at a more deep level, who need to be invited in to a community of folks who are taking their faith seriously and taking seriously what it means to live out your academic life as an expression of faithfulness to Christ. And the bigger our groups are, the more people are doing that. It's not about numbers, it's about those people. So think about that as well. We're dismissed for lunch. We'll be back in here at 4 o'clock. Lori has an announcement to make, because I probably forgot something, I'm sure.
Right after lunch, okay.
Ah, thank you. Lori Thabit is an angel. I'll just say that. Woo! Yay, Lori. Mike Shutt. There is also lunches, professional school lunch, one for business, one for law, in the Indonesia room, where all the women were having fun this morning. we get to have, the rest of us get to have fun this over lunch. So join those tables for lunch. Volunteering with InterVarsity. You guys have been, it's a great gift.
I just, yeah. Yeah. I Yeah, that's what I